Welcome to Tactical Permaculture. I've worked on projects ranging from the poorest to richest clients, from inner cities to suburbs to farmlands to remote wilderness, from the eco-war front lines to celebrity backyards. In over 25 years of service to the earth and the community of life, I've learned that in the fight for sustainable survival, growing is half the battle. Please go to tacticalpermaculture.com to read my blog, watch my videos, view my photos, access web applications, and click on the join membership link to access exclusive features. April 17th, 2024, episode number 130. I'm excited to announce the launch of a new tool I just finished building in this current alpha beta testing mode, if you will. This is open for revisions and contributions, feature requests, bug reports, and whatnot, but it's called the Site Intelligence Report Designer. And to explain what that means, if you are a certified permaculture designer or an enthusiast, and you've ever advised or consulted or helped out with a permaculture project or had your own clients, then undoubtedly you had some method by which you did research about the site, that you interviewed the client with a questionnaire or with a more of an interview type of format. There's always the need to compile data, everything from maps to soil tests to anecdotes and reports and folklore and all kinds of anything you can discover that's relevant to what you want to be putting in that cauldron to create that stew that is the design process. And so it's nice to have, everyone's got their own way of doing things. Certainly people are still using pen and paper and whatnot, but in terms of modern technology we have available, I would say my perspective is to create the most minimally invasive in terms of privacy tools, and also have them be secure by design. So what I've built is an application that allows the site, the leader of the design, if you will, the person who's responsible for fielding in all this information about the site and being very dynamic about how that information can be amended, how it can be edited and changed, and how it's all going to flow downstream to eventually the decisions that are made for design. So like I said, people could be doing this on paper and pen. They could be using a suite of cloud platform products is probably the way I'll put it, to be kind of broad. What I'm doing is I'm creating tools where there's no sharing of the data with a cloud provider, and it's a far more private and secure experience by design. I've talked at length about what those design parameters are. I'm going to just mention that briefly here, as I always do, talking about what the security profile is of the tool itself, the privacy profile. And at this current stage, it is a tool where you go to the tool website from my tools page, and that website is the app, it is the tool. So you can either save that page and use it offline in a browser that's not even connected to the internet, because there's no communication back and forth between my server after the file is downloaded. All you're doing is downloading the file, and then you're not interacting with my server when you interact with it in your browser. And that means that it is portable in the sense that you can use it offline, or you can use it on a computer that's not even connected to the internet at all, and just run it in a browser. And then I built in the tool so that you can save and export and resume your work. So it works like a web page, but it's a web page that you have the ability, once you save it and download it, to continue to iterate upon it in your own private realm without sharing it with anybody that you don't want to. So eventually, if you wanted to email your work in progress HTML file that you will have that could be saved and resaved over and over as you work on it, you could attach and email that file to a client, and then they could open it in a browser, and you wouldn't be making any resource calls or pulling in anything unless you put links in there. If you said, hey, I'm going to put a bunch of links in here you can click on, then it will be, your browser will be wanting to connect to the internet to do that. But in terms of being able to have a, you might call it backwards compatible, but the idea is it's you're independent of my server. Once you download it, you can run it offline, you can share it privately, you can work on it privately, and it's not quote unquote phoning home to report back to my server what all of the input, all the data you're putting in and all that. And as we know, a lot of the platform in the cloud, that's their whole business model, is to extract the context and the content of what you're doing so they can have a bidding war with advertisers in real time and make your browser crash. I don't go for any of that stuff. I'm going to say it right now, I think I would be selling out if I ever did anything like that. So hopefully I can afford to never sell out. And if I do, I will be very transparent about it. But right now, this is about my ethics of being independent from a lot of the systems that we're trying to replace with permaculture. So always got to have that kind of disclaimer, explain that in depth. As much as necessary and as much as it relates to the functioning of this tool. So moving right along, what is it that you get if you go to this tool website? You get to build basically you're starting with the template framework that you can extend and build upon, or you can edit and modify to fit your needs. But basically the idea is, in my designer history, I have used my own methods of fielding information about a site, and I've used other pre-formatted interview questions and questionnaire packets and whatnot. And so what I've built now is basically an original work of influenced by my direct experience and by my use of various tools over the course of many years. And this is a synthesis of all that experience and information, to where it could just be a list of things to check off. It could just be a pure checklist. That's another thing I didn't mention. And this is also derived from my experience of my own checklists and various checklists that I've had with clients and crews and whatnot. So if I want to synthesize all of that sort of intelligence and make a tool that is extensible and very dynamic and editable, in the sense that you could create checklists within checklists, you could create interviews questions with checkboxes, you could basically build your own. The idea is that this template gives you a starting point, and then you can build your own process based on it, where you are able to add information in. It's not exactly like a form. It's more like a list of headings and subheadings that I refer to as branches. So you get to get into the anatomy of it. Basically, you get you have up to 5 different branch sort of types, counting 1 through 5. And the first branch is basically your parent categories, your broad categories, and then each sub branch below that is going to kind of indent the item on the page, so it's easy to visually follow the branching out process and go, okay, this is the sort of the main category, and then there's a list of subtopics or sub questions or whatever it's going to be, and then within those it can keep branching out all the way down to 5 points. And then at each level, at each of those branches, there's an option to add what I call a leaf to that branch. So that is where you list the final endpoint of that consideration. The first of these, I'm going to walk through it, but yeah, you choose the whether it's a leaf or a branch, and which sort of size or which how far out of that branch is from the trunk, if you will. You choose that, and then you can add that, and it will create a blank new item that you can edit, and it'll start that. It'll put that at the bottom of the whole list of whatever you've got going. And right now, it's starting out. It's pretty long, but if you wanted to delete all of these and start over, I'll make it possible in another tool where it's just a blank slate, and then you wouldn't have to be adding all the way at the bottom of this whole list. But since this is a template for the purposes stated above, yeah, point is you add a new item from the menu at the top. It's going to put that item at the bottom of your list, and then you have the button to save and export at any time. That's going to automatically create a title or a name for the file that's being exported as an HTML file. It's going to derive that from the date. So obviously you can change that. You can rename it to the site name or whatever versioning system you want to use, but it starts out by default by giving a file name that is Site Intelligent Report Designer, and then it gives you, it's saying Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. That's what I'm looking at right now. And then next to that, importantly, there is a gear icon at this top menu bar, where if you click on that gear icon, you're basically toggling the display of all of the different units, all the different items, and all of their edit options. So you can take away the toolbars, basically, or hide the toolbars of all that are next to all the items. I'm going to explain them in a minute, but it's important to know that you can use that gear tool at the top, which is going to show and hide all of the toolbars for each of the items below. That way you can clean up the document. If you're sharing this document, which I'm not ready to turn this into a real-time collaborative online experience, because that would require a lot of encryption overhead that it would be forthcoming on my roadmap of development for what I'm doing on my server. But for now, if you wanted to make a presentation, if you wanted to clean it up and walk through it and just have those tools disappear to give you a more clean looking document, then you can click that to toggle that on and off. Starts out with them on by default. So now we get into the intelligence of the intelligence report, which is the template items that I'm starting you off with, and the logic behind them. I'm going to be extremely brief. I'm probably not going to even explain them in detail. This is the first sort of version of this, so probably later on I'll walk through actually using it for a real design process and talk about the history and the meaning behind each of the template items. But they're pretty self-explanatory. If I feel like it needs a little explanation, I'll give it some, but now I just want to go down from the top so you have the idea of what you'd be starting with. And so, yeah, starting with, I'm gonna actually start with listing off the top, the branch one categories, and then I'm gonna go one by one and follow their branches subsequently within each of those main categories. So the main categories you start with: history, geography, watershed, access, structures, climate, energy, sun, wind, soil, neighborhood, legal, financial, design, waste stream, on-site resources, wild vegetation, wildlife, sectors and vectors, and those are the main categories. So if you can think of anything that I'm missing from those, it's all relative, because some of these items, the sub-items, they could be interchangeable. You could create top level topics or categories out of depending on, and that's the beauty of it. You can recreate this as you go along. You could say, oh, I don't like this here, I think it should be its own category, I'm going to break it, and you have basically up to five different branches you can move. So yeah, let me get into that was the list of the branch of the main branches at this point. Now we'll get into the sub branches. But first, I want to give the, starting from the top, I want to give the list of tools that you have to work with per each item. And this is just a starting point for me. Obviously, there's a lot of things I could be adding to this, but just to get a working proof of concept so that I could get to this point where this is a usable document or usable app. Yeah, this is just the first phase of this toolbar. But what you get from left to right is you get like a pin icon. It's a button where if you click on it, it takes you into the title of the item, the list item there, so you can edit, modify it. And right now, there's restrictions on the type of markup you can put in there, because for security reasons, you want to strip out various tags and whatnot. So it's just plain text and numbers. So you can put in whatever you want there, and you can edit it. Well, that's the point. Whatever you started the item off with, it gives you just a blank unit, so you can type in whatever you want there. And after you type it in, do something else, you decide you want to go back and you want to change that, you have that edit button. You can click on it, it'll click you into there, and then you can modify the contents. And you can even use the enter to create a list within that, so that you actually have line breaks within that. So you'll see how it works. You could be adding individual items. If you wanted to make a list, you could just be adding discrete items, or you could use the enter key and you could make a list out of one section. However you want to do it, you have that option. You're not limited to just one line. That's the point of that. So the next button is a diamond icon indicating the priority level. So when you click on that, the color of the text of the item is going to change. It's basically like an alert level, so you know if you want it to. It's green if it's checked off. If you want it to be completed, you can mark it. You can click through this button, mark it green. You got yellow, orange, and red as the sort of priority levels, and that can be changed over time. So if you want to escalate the priority of something, you click on the button that is on the toolbar to the right of that item, and then you can change its priority color. And then you'll be able to know, okay, these are all completed, these are kind of neutral, or these are low priority, mid priority, high priority. That's the point of that. And you just click that button to change it, and you click it and it cycles through all the different color options. So you may be clicking it once, you may be clicking it two or three times, but just to get around the dial till you get back to the color that you want. Okay, next we have the up and down buttons, and that gives you the ability to take an item and maybe decide you want to put it within a different branch. You want to put it on a lower branch on this tree system. You can drop it down pressing the down button, or move it up with the up button. That's also cool if you have different sections where you want to duplicate it. That's where we get to the next button. It's a copy button. So you can copy an item, and it will include the type of item it is, whether it's a branch or leaf, and what number of branch or leaf it is, which is going to determine its size and its indentation. So if you copy an item, it's going to give you the input that you put in, and the sort of category that it is. So if you, let's say you had a number of items that belonged in several different branches, then you can copy the item, and then you can use the up and down buttons to move it wherever you want it to be. That was useful even as I was building this out. There were branches that had similar topics beneath them, so I was just able to duplicate and move them around. I've said before, another version of something like this I built, the drag and drop functionality, that's something I would need a grant for, because it's not pretty and it's not easy. It's not that it needs to be easy, but it's really squirrely the way the protocol that you're working with, the limitations of it. So for now, to have this just work as it is, I'm cool with that. The drag and drop functionality is something that could be added later, but to me it's not critical. It can be done without it. So I'm going to leave it as it is for now. The next button is a trash can icon, and that will delete the item, which is simple enough, but it's great because there's a running count of how many items you have here, and it's important. It updates that. It's kind of behind the scenes, not really important to think about. But if you have an item that is completed, you're ready to check it off, and you don't want it to just be there lingering, After it's no longer relevant, you can delete it. Or if you're modifying this template for your own purposes and you say, these don't apply, none of these template items, or not none of them, but hopefully not none of them, but some of them don't apply, so you just eliminate them by clicking the trash can, and then the page will automatically adjust and remove that item, and everything else will kind of slide where it needs to go once that item's deleted. The next button, the last one so far, or the last one in this version, is a plus symbol, where it gives you the ability to add an item directly below the current item that you're on. And that's useful because if you were to use the add item, the add new item button at the top, it's always going to default to creating that new item at the bottom of the list. So you may be bouncing back and forth along the document, working on different areas, and it's going to be useful to be able to add an item exactly where you are. And again, you add it. Once you add it, it's going to you will have the ability to edit it and to change its priority and to move it up and down as you see fit. So those are all the tools for now. Pretty intuitive, pretty standard, expected. And any suggestions for things that would be that should be added to that, I'd be happy to include them. So now I'm going to actually go into what's on this template list. So the history, I've got previous uses, previous issues, usage timeline, and that breaks down into how long have you been there, how long do you intend to stay. So those are some just basic, this is give you the idea. You want to be able to answer those questions. You want to investigate and study and do interviews with clients and whatnot. And they may not know the answer, so you may have to go to find external sources. But previous uses, what are the occupants doing before this? Was it a gas station? That's important to know. Was it a toxic waste brownfield dump site? Was it by train tracks? Or what are those previous uses and issues? Maybe there are beneficial uses. Maybe there's a shelter or bunker buried within it that you can use. So that kind of historical information, the usage timeline, that's pretty self-explanatory. But with that said, you get an idea of what the point is of having this sort of template that you can use, because maybe some of these things don't apply. And maybe you want to add to this, but you will at least know that you didn't space out on this important intelligence, which is what a permaculture design process is all about, is fielding intelligence and making good design decisions based on it and adapting with new intelligence. So it's critical to, you may not have, you know, you could add a sub item. That's what I would do. So previous uses, oh, we don't know anything about that history. So I'm going to mark that with a higher priority. I'm going to add an item below it. Just says, put in a bunch of question marks and make that a priority. So then this becomes a sort of to-do list, and it's actionable at that point as well, because whatever, maybe you get to the first question or the first item under history, previous uses, and you go, oh, I have a list of all those. So bam, that then create a new item here and copy and paste or type in that whole list. And if that's done, then mark it green. Or if it's a work in progress, you could mark it orange or whatever you want to do. But the point is, this is why it's a template. This is how it's editable. You can continue to reiterate upon that. So those were the items for history. We'll go into geography now. Now that you kind of get a sense, that was the sort of sidebar about the logic of all this. So I'll get going a little faster. We've got square footage or acreage, elevation, slope, contour lines, rock outcroppings, peaks, cliffs, valleys, maps. Under maps, you've got official, photos, drawn, other. So again, not all these may apply. Some of them are just sort of food for thought, because there's obviously all kinds of other landforms that could be going on, and then you can add them and you can list them, and you could even, you know, if you wanted to put in as a note, put in their GPS coordinates or describe them. All of that is extensible, but this gives you the bare minimum. Oh, I should ask about that. Oh, I don't know about that. Yeah, that could be critical and vital to know. I need to know that not now or sooner rather than later. Now or rather than later. So those are some pretty straightforward things with geography. Watershed, this is where it gets real interesting. So obviously inches of rain per year, catchment infrastructure, meaning what kind of water catchment systems you have, water tanks, rain barrels, something on a bigger scale, etc., catchment ponds, whatnot, plumbed access points. That'd be where can you tie in if you have whatever kind of system you have of pipes, where can you, where are the spigots at near the structures, and are there, yeah, various points to tap into. Wild access points, meaning are there springs, are there, is there snow melt, other water features naturally that can be tapped into. Low points, upstream vectors, downstream considerations, ponding opportunities, flood areas, storm runoff, erosion patterns, wells or potential well sites. Those are all pretty self-explanatory. Yeah, it's important to know who you would be affecting downstream from your usage of any kind of water, anything in a watershed, as well as upstream vectors. Are you downslope from a strip mine? That's important to note. So yeah, it's pretty obvious stuff. Access, roads, fences, pathways, security advantages, security disadvantages. Those are all items where you could be referencing various documents. I'm not adding the sort of attachment feature at this point, although that's certainly something that could be a feature in the future, where if you wanted to say, oh yeah, this is where I've attached all of the relevant files, maps, and photos and whatnot, they can live sort of in a folder system where you attach the link to the local file, or it could be a link out to a shared document somewhere else. Those are features to be added if they're requested, but for now the idea is more about gathering the sort of data that would be, you're walking around a site, what roads do you see, what roads are overgrown, what roads need repair, what does that look like, can you draw it out on a napkin, or do you have GPS satellite photos, whatnot. So same with fences and pathways, it's more fine grain, where are people walking and whatnot. Security advantages and disadvantages, yeah, there could be, yeah, that's where all the tweakers hang out and get through that hole in the fence over there. That's let's make that a high priority, stuff like that. Or hey, there's a cliff right there and we're at the top of it, so pretty safe from that angle of attack. So moving along, structures, so homes, workshops, offices, schools, fixed, movable, square footage, current uses, potential uses. So here you could see how these could be copied and moved around per, maybe there's 5 homes and 2 workshops and an office and a school. It could be a whole village that you're using to design with this. So there could be multiple subsections where you're duplicating things and you're giving different profiles of them. So this kind of gives you those ingredients to kind of move around, or at least the ideas for them. So if you wanted to recreate them or rename them, you at least know, yeah, you know, it's important to think about if this structure is movable or not, because then it could totally change its function within the design if it's fixed or if it's movable. And then you can compare them by their square footage, and these are all important profile metrics and data to have about what's already going on the site. And then climate, average chill hours, frost start and end date ranges, length and range of growing seasons, USDA hardiness zone, and then within typical high and low yearly temperatures. And then we have another category within this, which is microclimates, useful, problematic, or limiting. Those are the out of the box default of the template. So microclimates, if you're not aware, they're places where the broader climate fluctuates for some reason. It could be a frost pocket or a place that gets a lot more wind because of its placement on a slope. Could be a place where heat collects, like on the surface of water, and you can design around and work with those. Sometimes you can modify them or even create them or inhibit them. So it's useful to be thinking about what microclimates exist and whether they're beneficial or problematic and whatnot, that are just sort of already there. Then we get into energy, and this is solar, grid, air conditioning, heating systems. That's just a off-the-cuff list. There's other, I mean, people might have different generators or have other, all kinds of other kinds of hydroelectric and whatnot. So this is just not necessarily a checklist, but it is an idea that if you're on a site, how are they getting their power currently, and what are the uses of that? Air conditioning, heating systems, etc. Are they on grid? Are they on solar? What is the sort of, what's the story that you want to be telling about energy? Next one, this, there's a lot of permutations to this, but just to make it simple, sun, and fill out and have an understanding of shade areas and patterns. So that would include an understanding of the angle of the sun, the summer sun, the angle of the winter sun, and that's why I'm leaving it open as patterns. You can add all that stuff, listing the different areas of shade and how you want to design and deal with those situations. But basically the way it is as you arrive, the current status of it, that's what you want to get an understanding of. And so next is wind. So prevailing wind, wind blocks needed, wind blocks in place. Winds can be a very destructive feature, so it's one of the most important elements of dealing with it in design. Important to have all this information. So those are pretty straightforward though. The soil section is next. So test documentation, pH type, composition type, depth of topsoil, depth of subsoil. Depending on how much of a soil scientist you are, you could add all kinds of subcategories and top-level categories within this. But basically the idea is some sites, they've already had a soil test done and they've got it somewhere in a drawer. So if you can find that documentation, great. Otherwise, you can do your own sort of spot treatment of pH testing if you're going to be growing different crops that have different acidity and alkalinity profiles. The composition type is basically having an intelligence about what the components of the soil is, including silt, sand, and clay, the main components that you're going to find. And there's something called a jar test, where if you take a sample of the soil and put it in a jar, a quart jar with water, and shake it up, those ingredients or those elements, those sizes of grain, of dirt, basically, they're going to separate into layers and give you a good sense of what the percentage or the ratio of those layers is. So that's what composition type. If you had done this a number of times professionally, you would have that experience. So yeah, its composition is it's sandy clay or clay sand or however you want to phrase it. Basically, whatever that ratio is going to literally shake out to. So next one is neighborhood. This is more the social environment, but we've got mutual aid patterns, contracts, agreements, liabilities, belligerents, sound restrictions, parking restrictions, gathering size restrictions. I'm looking forward to, if I do go through this again and I actually reference my experiences with designing for and against and with all these different factors, but the idea of belligerent neighbors that make life miserable for anything you try to do, and they're going to throw the book at you with the HOA, they're going to throw the book at you with the height of the grass limitations and what fruit and vegetables you can't grow because it's not ornamental enough in the front yard, and then they're the ones who call the cops or they call code enforcement about your parties and your work parties and your gatherings. So parking restrictions, sound restrictions, gathering size restrictions, those are all things I've had to deal with, the friction of neighbors around. Even, well, try, of course, and the point is to respect and understand the circumstances, and then you have to do the fence mending in order to kind of grease the wheels of being allowed to do some of this stuff. If you want to have work parties, you want to have people do PDCs or have lots of even contractors and whatnot, that can be something that the neighbors are going to want to be notified. You're going to want to promise them Don't sell them an unregistered securities offering. Don't get into a contract with them, but you might say, hey, if you're cool with me doing this for a couple months, you know, you're going to be blessed with fruits from the garden afterwards. So moving right along. Oh, we're already at legal, so that's perfect. Perfect segue. So legal, I've got zoning, building permits, horticultural restrictions, HOA, neighborhood groups, conservation restrictions, water use limitations, rain catch, legal status, and legal counsel. So all those are pretty obvious. I don't feel like I need to go into much detail about them. That's intelligence you want to have, to know that official stuff, know what kind of issues you may be inheriting on a land site. And that's information you may not get from a realtor. That's information you're going to get from the state or the county, someone who knows what the legacy is that's going into that history as well. But having ideally a legal professional within your organization or that's accessible to you, so that they would understand how to navigate getting some of this information and then navigating the responsibility to act in compliance with that information. Once you have it, you can't claim ignorance of it, which isn't an excuse, but mens rea is big in the whole legal system. They've got to prove that you were aware of wrongdoing in order to throw the book at you. Otherwise, that's a mitigating factor. If you were just a reasonable, well-meaning, prudent individual who was operating on the best intelligence they had. But you do this research and you get this intelligence, now you would be in bigger trouble if you tried to destroy the evidence of having had that intelligence. So I'm not going to give you advice on how to store this information once you have it, but do know that once you are aware of something, you therefore become responsible to adhere to the parameters of it, more responsible than you would be if you didn't even know. So don't be fooled. Ignorance isn't bliss. You want to know this stuff, you want to be compliant, and you want to have legal resources that can help you navigate a very difficult to navigate system of rules and laws. And that's an ongoing process, and I'm no expert myself. So next, what happens if you do that wrong? Then you get into problems in the financial sector here. So the financial list is, if it's owned, is there mortgage debt? Is it paid off? Is it titled to a trust? What's the property tax situation? Is it a monthly rental, long-term lease? Are there debts and liens? What's the insurance status? Liability for damages, liability for injuries, for guest injuries. I add those because who's the primary legal and liable person financially? So if there's a lawsuit, is it in a trust? Is it a corporate entity? How are you limiting your liability for financial ruin and bankruptcy if anything ever goes wrong? That's an important consideration. So that goes right along with legal considerations. Those are all pretty straightforward. Understanding the financial situation and the ownership situation. Next, we get into where all this sort of comes together and informs your design considerations. So starting with zonation activities, permaculture design, if you are not familiar, it behooves a site designer to map out the various zones of use within a site. So there's a lot of ways to teach that. There's a lot of ways to do that and to practice it. But for the sake of this tool, I'm defining it as follows, and this is the way it breaks down. So you have a section under zonation activities, the subsection including maps 0 through 5, where you could describe it, you could be referencing a file or a link to a map or whatnot, however you want to include that intelligence. But the idea is you should know from observation and from interviews, you should know what activities happen that are not private activities. What activities happen, the uses of the home or uses of the facility. Is there a cottage industry going on? Is it a home school? Are there crafts being made? Is there a boutique food processing happening? What are some of the the activities and uses of the home. And if it's not a home, what kind of facility, if it's a business or school, what's going on? What is the function or functions within that facility itself? And then directly outside of that, and we go into zone one, and that's what in zonation theory, you might, to make it simple, you would call it the daily uses. Oh, there's a kitchen garden that I cut herbs from every day, and that is one of the daily uses. And then I may, on the zone two, it could be weekly uses. Oh, I take out the trash or I do the compost and whatnot. That would be zone two based on this loose association generally between the distance from zone zero or the distance from the main structure, the dwelling or the facility structure, generally speaking, but not always. And that's why it's not really pure concentric circles like a target or a dartboard. That's the conceptual design of zonation theory, is the idea of concentric circles on a dartboard, but it's more like an amoeba shape because a lot of these can kind of commingle and overlap. So just with that in mind, map of zone two, list of weekly uses. I would say an example would be composting and taking out the trash and whatnot. Zone three, more of a monthly use, generally speaking, a little further out, things you might do once a month, harvest from a certain area or check on something or whatever. Yeah, have a gathering, have a full moon event of some kind. That's another kind of consideration. And then zone four, map zone four, I would call that seasonal uses. And there's also, yeah, there's other sort of lists of what these zones are good for. Some people would say a zone four is where you're growing trees and sort of managing a forest of fuel, fiber, and fodder crops and whatnot. Not so much the human garden, but more of a functional use cultivation environment and whatnot. But it's just that would be the idea. Oh, it's seasonal because I go harvest leaf litter in the fall, and I bring that back into the previous zones for use. Or I do coppicing or pollarding, tree care, arborist type of works for seasonal uses. Or there's a seasonal stream or pond, and so that's a time or a list of seasonal uses that will be based on the time of year and the water level and whatnot. And then zone five, typically wilderness areas, so wilderness uses, would you be hunting, wildcrafting, hiking, etc. Those are things that, these could be things that are already happening or that are in the works and planning, a client would like to be happening within these areas. But this gives you a list, an idea, make sure you have a sense of what's going on in all these different zones. And then the last one within the zonation activities is the flow patterns between zones. So that's where I was kind of narrating above, what is, if you know what the main uses are that are sort of isolated to the zones, what are the interesting opportunities that exist in the patterns of use between them? Because maybe it makes sense to bundle something a certain way because you know you're going to come back and use it when you do the monthly cycle or the seasonal cycle or whatnot. These can all be optimized in relation to each other. They're not separate and walled off. They're very integrated and very interconnected. That's the whole point of all this. So next one in under the broader category of design is people. So this would be creating basic profiles of the individuals who are occupying the land. It could be a family, it could be a unit of an organization, it could be business, whatever it is. But we've got, just to start you off with as a template, name, age, professional skills, area of interest or study, dietary preferences, dietary restrictions, hobbies and leisure activities, project time commitment, meaning how are they interested, are they bought in, are they going to help, or they don't care? What's their time commitment to this? Project budget contribution, again, are they bought in? Do they want to contribute money so that you know what you can budget for doing different and prioritizing different design installations and whatnot? And then their limitations, allergies, medical conditions, that kind of gives you a sense of what to design for and what to be aware of. Certainly if they've got allergies, you want to design accordingly. Then we have pets, and this is where it gets into more of the traditional way of listing the characteristics of animals on the site, or pretty much any site design, but I would find it to be just a little bit over-humanizing to use all those listed above for people, and under-humanizing to swap what's the list for people with this more trite, or not trite, but a concise list. But for pets, we've got names, needs, characteristics, and behaviors, and so that's pretty obvious. What kind of food do they eat? What do they have? Are they very passive or very aggressive by nature? How do they behave? Do they eat pests? Do they damage elements of the design that you want to keep them out of? You need to know how to increase the benefits and minimize the issues caused by pets. And then by extension, next level down is livestock. Same thing, needs, characteristics, behaviors. Not everybody names their livestock. That's obviously optional. These are all optional. Below that, planted vegetation. So gardens, the size, location, description. You could add to that as much as you want. And then plant list. This is good intelligence to have as far as what I've got here. Annuals, perennials, medicinals, root, ground cover, herbaceous, shrubs, low trees, high trees, and vining. So if you know permaculture design, you know that the last seven of those are actually the categories of a seven-layer food forest design, where you're wanting to fill the eco niches vertically across a diagonal gradient so that everything can get adequate sunlight, and you're maximizing the potential of that diagonal vertical gradient edge, if you're familiar with that. But I'll leave it at that. But the idea is, there's we've already got plenty of edible root crops in place. We can leave that as it is. Or, wow, there's a lot of bare soil. We better get some ground cover for that, et cetera, et cetera. You're going to be filling in all those variables as that forest ecology reverse engineering process is what I would call it. So that gives you, as far as what has been planted within that plant list, what's all in that list, and then how do those group together? How do those yield various types of even more significant intelligence as they get grouped and sorted in the manner that I have done, or you can obviously change it how you see fit. That's a good starting point, I believe. And then another set of design considerations, pretty straightforward. Outdoor recreational features, other landscaping features, cultural aesthetics, culinary preferences, outdoor activities, privacy concerns, goals, issues to resolve, issues to mitigate, commercialization potential. That meaning, do you want to grow or make stuff and sell it? Do you want to be really a financial cottage industry homestead? What's the potential for that? And the rest of those are pretty straightforward. But as far as the other landscaping features, that could be things like pools, pergolas, trellis, different types of pathways, of flower gardens, whatever you would see landscape professionals providing, or they see something in a magazine or a website, they say, or I want to install that feature. So those are kind of more traditional landscaping features that they may have in mind, outdoor kitchen, etc. Even then the outdoor recreational features, so maybe they want an area to do various games or sports and whatnot. So those are all pretty standard kind of landscaping concerns as far as design considerations. And then another one here is views, and subcategories being views to keep, to expand, to block, or design according to. So they could be favorable or unfavorable views, but those are important things to know, because you don't want to start, this is the place with the best soil, but the worst view. How are we going to reconcile that and come to a compromise? That's important to be aware of. So it's definitely not to be overlooked, no pun intended. Next, we've got waste stream. So this could obviously change, but it's a Is there grid plumbing, septic, composting, toilets? What's the trash, recycling, and compostable situation? That's all important to know what services, obviously, are they signed up for and what are the limitations of that? What can they do with what they have? What are the restrictions on that? That's all part of understanding that the waste stream, how can they obviously enrich it and optimize it? Next is on-site resources. So this list can go on forever, but to give you a few items as food for thought, the infrastructure, greenhouse, building materials, tools, equipment. Man, I have scavenged places and found the most interesting, overgrown, rusting, discarded tools and equipment that they would never know about unless they did a real thorough scavenging operation of recon throughout the site. So that's been a lot of my work, has been a lot of that kind of recon. So it can be very dangerous. So definitely use your protective equipment with that. So those are pretty obvious. Moving along, wild vegetation, important to know. Invasive, poisonous, useful, edible, medicinal, aromatic, trellis potential, privacy screen potential, compost mulch potential, threats to structures, marketable, arborist consult. So a couple of those, threats to structures. Is there a branch that's about to fall on your roof in a storm? Marketable, is there stuff that you might be able to sell if you sustainably harvest it? Now, arborist consult is something very important I added to this for wild vegetation, is that it's very important to have a very competent arborist at every site where there are any trees of any considerable height, because their disease and health state is going to determine whether or not they need to be, I mean, that is almost one of the first things to get an understanding of right away, because I've been on project sites where an arborist is brought in and I've subcontracted to them, and the arborist comes in and tells the client, you know, you got to get rid of half of these trees, and there goes your whole budget at that point. So can I get rid of, what can we triage it a little bit more, because I want to have a budget for a garden? I mean, come on. But they will mortify you with what you wish you didn't have to know about how dangerous to your structures, to your safety, to your neighbors. A lot of trees are diseased with climate change. It's getting worse, and they can become very dangerous. So a professional arborist is going to know what needs to be cut back, what needs to be cut down, what needs to be immediately quarantined and then dealt with in a very hygienic manner in order to not spread disease. It's very important, and those are the real pillars of the design, because that could mean maybe they're protected, maybe you can't cut it or even touch it, and therefore the area you wanted to garden in, it's shaded out and you can't mess with it at all. Or you get to have a whole new garden area because the arborist says these trees got to go, and that's going to open up a whole bunch more sunlight into the site. So definitely budget for and don't. Yeah, budget for arborist consultation, or go and become an arborist. I know friends that have done that. So it's not my area of expertise, but I know what I don't know and when I need to to call somebody who knows what I don't know. Okay, next is wildlife. So poisonous, venomous, biting, stinging, pathogenic, crop-eating, crop-damaging, beneficial predators, endangered or protected, habitats to avoid disturbing, habitats to move or to inhibit. So yeah. You're operating on not just property owned by some legal human entity. You are potentially an uninvited guest on property that's really inhabited by the wildlife, and they can give you a very bad day. They can end your life. They can be very, like I said, pathogenic. You want to get Lyme's disease because you didn't manage certain vectors on the site. That's a major consideration, and it's growing across all regions because of climate temperatures changing across the world. So pathogen vector, pathogen carrying insects and other critters, that's something to be worried about. So that's something I want to highlight on this list. But everything else is pretty straightforward on that. We get to the last main section, which is sectors and vectors. So we've got pollution, noise, smell, and then hazards, emergency risks, and disaster risks. So under hazards, I've got issues with structures. Obviously, if they're condemned and about to fall over, you need to be aware of that. Power lines, Where are power lines and what is their status? Drainage pipes, sewer pipes, septic, buried electrical, other wires and pipes, chemical leaks and spills, other hazardous material contamination. Those are all hazards that, you might be consulting with previous owners or the county or other institutions that might have some of that information. And you definitely want to design according to that and then keep those records very well maintained. And that's an ongoing process of making sure that people know if you buried a bunch of new pipes and new lines and whatnot, or you notice or you create issues with structures as you're building things, it happens. You got to know what you're liable for, and you better have insurance for what you're doing if you're modifying anything or even advising to modify anything. This is very general advice what I'm giving right here, so that's my disclaimer. You have to hire your own insurance agency, hire your own counsel. I will say these are the things that I put them last because they're the least fun. You don't want to put them at the top and bum somebody out. Put them last, and then you'll have a lot of things to look forward to already established in the imagination of your client. And then you get to the part that's the least fun. So that's the list of the hazards. And I would say just a couple of considerations here. Obviously, this is very, very trimmed down. You will be adding a lot to this, but I just created the broadest categories because I'm not going to list every possible emergency and disaster potential. That's all something you would want to do. But to have essentially a framework of categories to start with, yeah, want to list the emergency risks, and then I made it break that down into natural and human-made. Same with disaster risks. What are the natural and human-made? So you can add as many items below that, list them, move them around, duplicate them, and add them in both areas, whatever you want to do. And that is the end of the app document at this current state. So I will be, I don't know, this could be 100 times longer eventually by the end of my life, because I like the idea of laying out at least within reason, laying out as many different things, sort of starting points, branch points on this as are really critical. And then let the things that are very site-specific or very nuanced, those are the things that you can fill in as you go along. But the things that I believe at this point are non-negotiable intelligence you've got to have, to me, from the most, not frivolous, but the most sort of benign, like, do you want a pergola or not, to the legal and the financial considerations of liabilities and the hazards and risks and whatnot. These are starting points for gathering intelligence that I would want to have. And this is sort of, now that I have the time to do this, I had never sat down before to create such a comprehensive template for this process. And that is what this is all about. I mean, I've done a lot of talks on my show about the philosophy and the need for it and whatnot, but this is where it really is 100% about being practical here. This is the design process. So of all the pictures on my website and all of the philosophical shows, behind all that is this intelligence gathering, decision making, problem solving, very adaptive and dynamic intelligence process. And this can involve a lot of people. If you're doing your own site, then by all means, it'll be easy to go through this, relatively speaking. If you're working on a crew and you have a company that you're responsible working within, and then there's a hierarchy of who talks to the clients about what, then handing off and managing this design documentation or intelligence reporting process is going to get more complex. But I believe that this is well suited to be a very extensible starting point for people. And I'm going to be hesitant to add features that sort of breach its inherent elegance of security and privacy. But there's always ways to add enhanced privacy and security when you do integrate more features. And that's my commitment to my web design, web app development process. So for now, you've got something to where, I'll tell you what, for me and for you, you had no excuse to act like you didn't know that all this stuff is at least worth considering or considerable. Even if you don't think it's worth considering, you now are made aware of its existence. There's no turning back. And for me, for myself or for anyone else, if I do a permaculture design, certainly if I sell it, when I'm selling my services along the way in the process, if I fail to address any of the items on this template as it is, then I am a hypocrite. I'm failing. I'm doing it wrong, and that's a problem. So trying to create these guardrails for ethics and for professionalism, accountability, and I'm excited about this. This, to me, is, again, what it's all about and how you do this. The design course trains you so that, I would say, anybody who completes a permaculture design course, they should be able to go and make this list for themselves. And they may start out and add a lot more to it, or they may decide. I think a lot of this stuff, it comes from experience as well. But that's what we do to compound that wisdom, is to help people learn more lessons easier, not so much the hard way. I've learned a lot of hard lessons. A lot of things on this list, I'll tell you later, but a lot of things on this list are there because I don't want that to happen again. Never again do I want to make that mistake. So this should help prevent that. So I hope you enjoyed this. And if you have feature requests or bug reports, there may be issues. This is an early release, so I will be updating and fixing it accordingly. So cheers.